Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. Pain can seize control of your life. It can cause you to seek relief in addiction and lead you to the worst places. It can turn isolated tragedy into pathology, and pathology can begin to feel like destiny. This is a train of thought Susie Scott Krabacher knows all too well. As a young woman who felt the lingering burden of childhood trauma, she desperately needed to escape the pain and to feel safe. And yet, while rising to fame in the early 1980s as a Playboy centerfold, an international symbol of beauty and glamour, she felt increasingly vulnerable. Given a different twist of fate, Miss May 1983 might be a sad character now. All that unspeakable pain could have destroyed her. But eventually she escaped that world and dealt with the dark memories swirling in her mind. She began to chase redemption and peace, determined to do something good and meaningful with her life. In this two-part American Achievers interview, Krabacher talks candidly about the heartbreaking childhood that set her on the road to the Playboy Mansion, the encounter with Hugh Hefner that still haunts her, and the life-affirming purpose she has found while leading a charity that cares for Haiti's most vulnerable children. Susie, what's your earliest memory?
Well, it's not a very good one. golly, I've never started an interview with that question. My earliest memory is screaming in my crib because I didn't understand what was happening to me. I had my grandfather was a serial pedophile, and I was one of his victims, as well as my little brother and my neighbor. That was my first memory, unfortunately.
Obviously, you suffered abuse for a long time. How did you deal with that as a child?
I think I'm dealing with it now more than I did then. The first time I remember it, like I said, I was, you know, a toddler. And I just thought I was supposed to obey, and I did. But part of me knew that even little kids understand shame and embarrassment. And growing up in a very strict religious household, I didn't want anyone to see my private parts. So I was so conflicted and so completely utterly confused, but scared to death. My mother was bipolar and borderline schizophrenic, so I couldn't tell her. She wouldn't understand, and if she did understand, it was a huge possibility that I would be blamed for it. Which, when she did finally walk in when I was 8 and found my grandfather on top of me in a bed, she did blame me. So I was I didn't have much of a chance either way. But thank the Lord, when I was 12, the state took me out of my biological parents' home and put me in foster care. And I had wonderful two very wonderful foster families that really put me on a level ground to start processing that this was what happened to me was not okay. It was not my fault. And just the first time I've ever felt safe and loved.
Let's go back a minute. Your mother's addiction and her mental problems, how did that shape your worldview at that point?
I tried to be very quiet and not get in her way. My mother owned a gun and threatened to use it often and slept with it by her bedside. She has bouts of suicidal motivation, pills or guns, or she's been in and out of the emergency room so many times I can't count them. My way of coping was, it sounds a little silly, but I think it's the way a lot of little kids who aren't in a stable home. I had an imaginary mom in my head. In my head, I had an imaginary mom that talked to me and said, I love you, you're so pretty, you're smart, you're gonna be okay. And I would get in bed at night and pretend that my imaginary mom was stroking my hair. And I lived in my imagination, because I don't know how any little kid can get through that kind of thing. The screaming, the trauma, the touching, the hitting, you have to escape somehow. And my imagination probably is what saved me. And it also created for me the belief that I could be something amazing. And I was very, very, very close to God. I mean, I'll never forget when I was 8, after this incident when my mother walked in and found my grandfather on top of me. God was the only thing that I knew of in my world that was good. And I said, if you save me from this, I promise I will save other little kids. I promise. Just please help me get through this.
So you have the presence of mind to actually start thinking about that at the very time that you were vulnerable and being abused.
It was the only place I had to go. I mean, I lived in rural Alabama, a place called Pateka. At that time, less than 500 people. And that was the world, that was the only world I knew. Those were the only people I knew. There was no place to go and tell. There was no place to report incidents until I got put in foster care. I thought this was all normal and that every little kid lived like that.
And eventually the family moved to Athens, right?
Yeah. And when I moved to Athens, I went to a different school. And one of my girlfriend's mothers saw handprints, bruises on my arms. And I broke down and told her, yeah, I'm getting beaten a lot. So she called social affairs, and immediately, same day, I was taken out of the house. And I cannot tell you the feeling of I'm never going to be hit again. And I never was. I mean, you don't know what that feels like, not to be in fear every single day that you're going to be grabbed by the hair or slapped or hit or, you know, a fist to the face. It's hard to explain if you haven't been through it. Women who are abused would definitely understand that. But as a little kid, you can't defend yourself.
And on Sunday afternoons, you would escape to a friend's house, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My preacher's daughter was kind enough to always invite me over on Sundays. And that was my fantasy world. It was a really normal house. The mother always had nice food on Sunday. We got to play outside. Even if it was raining, we would run through the rain. We would, you know, swim in the creek and play our imaginary games out and talk about boys, mostly Donny Osmond.
The foster home.
Yeah.
So that made you feel safe for the first time, right?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I loved my foster family, just loved them. And I felt like they loved me. And back then, I don't know what the rules are now, but the goal of the social affairs is to get you back integrated into your family again. But my mother refused to participate in therapy. So they would only let you stay with a foster family for a certain amount of time so that you don't get attached. So I was in three different foster families. And the last one was really more like a group home, you know, bars on the windows and a lock on the refrigerator, not just really crowded. And at that time, my father got a job that would take him out of Alabama to Utah. So I said, you know, I'll just go home. And as soon as they moved to Utah, by that time, my parents really didn't care much what I did. So as soon as we got to Utah, I moved out. I got a job, lied about my age, and got a really, really good job at a computer company as a operator.
And you were what, 15 years old? Is that right?
15. Uh huh.
How did you?
And I got my own apartment.
How did you pull this off? Come on.
I wasn't very honest. I said, you know, I know how to run a PBX machine, which is basically a telephone board that connects everybody to everybody else in the company. I said, I know how to do that. I'll be your best employee. I need this job. And lo and behold, within a month, I taught myself. Well, I got help from other employees at the company to work late at night and learn how to run the thing. But at 15, I had a really, you know, it was minimum wage, but for me, that was more than I'd ever been paid. And I had a roommate that was about three times my age, but I had my own apartment with her, and it was just, it was wonderful. Some of the best memories of my life was the freedom and feeling like I couldn't believe I did it. You know, I couldn't believe I pulled it off. I had to drop out of school, of course, because I couldn't work full time and pay rent.
What did your parents, how did they deal with that? Didn't they come looking for you?
No, no, no.
Now, how did that make you feel, that they didn't come after you?
I wasn't surprised. They told me that I could stay in their house if I paid them rent. And I thought, why would I stay here and pay them rent? So I decided I'm going to pay rent to somebody else and, you know, have my peace. These weren't normal. This wasn't a normal family structure.
And by this point, you were growing into a beautiful young woman, and you met.
I was kind of growing into, you know, a woman. Yeah. And, you know, had really long hair past my hips and, you know, starting to get a little attention from boys and men.
And at some point you met a photographer.
Yes.
How did that happen?
I was working at this company, and on 5 o'clock, you know, it was like cocktail time. So I was given by my roommate, the older woman, a fake ID so that I could go with them when they went to bars. And I met a photographer one night when I was, you know, I was always at the bars with the girls after work. And the photographer really wanted to get his work into Playboy. And he said, you know, you could be a model. You could make $100 a day. Let me take some pictures of you. I'll do it for free. And you can use them to get modeling jobs. So I did that. And I did start getting modeling jobs. I was really surprised. And I could make $100 a day, which was unheard of. I mean, I think I was making like $3.25 an hour at my job, which to me was a gold mine. And then when I found out that I could make $100 a day on the weekends, I was all over that. And then most models will tell you that you do have to have some comfort level and, you know, friendship with your photographer, because you have to trust them. And I did. I started really, had a great friendship with this guy, and he got me a lot of jobs. And then he asked if I would pose to send photos into Playboy, because his dream was to be a Playboy photographer, which ironically, I was accepted into Playboy, and this guy just rose to fame over the years, and is now, or Playboy's now closed, but he rose to be one of their top photographers. And I was his first centerfold.
So take me through that process. First of all, when you got the offer from Playboy, did that feel like an act of rebellion that you were purposely doing, or was it all about the money?
Well, it was, I think it was a mix. I, in my heart, even though I had really no affection for my mom, I did have affection for, I had pity for my dad. I was afraid that it would hurt him. And then I thought, you know, he never protected me or cared how I felt, so why should I worry about how he feels? And so I bargained with myself and went back and forth and back and forth, and I thought, okay, you know what I'll do? I want to be able to say that I went to the Playboy Mansion, and that's all I'm going to do. I'm just going to, you know, I want that adventure. I want that story to be able to tell. I'll go, but I'm not going to actually go through with it. I'm not going to take any pictures.
Did the abused girl need the validation, which was big in the culture at that point, of this, you know, being a playboy, you know, being pretty enough to be attractive to Playboy? Did the abused young girl need that?
I think every woman who has been treated in the way that I was treated, and living through that shame, you want to say, hey, you know what? You are not going to desexualize me. And I felt like it was going to be one way or another. For the rest of my life, I was going to live with shame about, you know, about being a sexual being. And this was for the first time somebody saying, you're beautiful, you're sexy, which I had never thought, would never allow myself to think I'm sexy. That was terrifying to me. So yeah, it was in a way like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm sexy and that's okay. It's not bad. It's good. Everybody's telling me that this is, you know, beautiful and art and it's nothing to be ashamed of. So yeah, you nailed it.
You've said in the past that you thought that God wasn't paying much attention to you at that point. What do you mean by that?
No. Well, you know, when you get older, you lose a little bit of your innocence because you see people being hurt. And myself, my story was so different than most normal people. I felt completely not normal. And I thought it wasn't fair. I worked myself to death to be able to pay my rent and was always very afraid that I didn't have enough money to buy myself lunch. And I was 15 and I'm thinking, I should be going to school. I should be having somebody pay for my shoes. And I'm living a complete and total lie because everybody thought I was 21. I told everyone I was 21. And so that, you know, I had some anger issues about that. And I didn't understand. My little brother was still stuck in that terrible home. And he was 11, turning 12, and had decided he was going to drop out of school. And, you know, it just seemed like our family was so messed up. And I was embarrassed by them. You know, why do you treat your children like this? We were just never a priority. And so, yeah, I had some anger issues and I wanted God to either do something or not. And I felt like he chose not. So I decided, well, I'm going to have to do something for my own self. I wasn't patient. I didn't know how to use my faith. So if you don't use it, I think it sort of atrophies.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for more conversation.
They offer you a life-changing amount of money at that point for you. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if I understood about the money. You know, by the time I posed for Playboy, I was 17. And up to that point, I didn't have a bank account or a checkbook. I kept all of my money in envelopes and paid my bills, you know, from envelopes. You know, maybe I'd have save $20 a month in an envelope in $1 bills to buy snacks when I was hungry. And then I would have $1 bills to pay for my gas. And, you know, I'd have $100 bill to pay my rent. I mean, I didn't understand money. All I knew is I would be able to pay my rent. And I went to my boss at work at the computer company and told him, I'm going to have to take some time off. And I remember I was shaking so bad because this man was so intimidating. And, you know, I was like nobody. I was the operator for the computer company and I didn't even know if he knew me. So I took this meeting with him and I said, I really want to keep my job, but I need to take a couple months off. And the reason is, and I told him I was posing for Playboy. And all of a sudden, I realized the power of that, because this very powerful man looked at me and said, you take as many months off as you want, we'll still pay you, and you have a job when you come back. And it was the power of all of a sudden a bit of celebrity, and people react to celebrity. So I'm thinking more and more, okay, yes, I'm definitely going out to LA. I'm going to get on that plane. I'm going to go out there, but I'm still not going to do the pictures.
So how did they change your mind?
Hefner, basically. I'll call him Hef. I got out there and I was just absolutely mortified because there was so much beauty. And Hefner met me at the door of this just majestic mansion with his amazingly beautiful girlfriend. And I'd never seen anyone so pretty. And he was in his bathrobe. And I'm thinking, all I want to do is get into my sweatpants and get into my bedroom and lock my door, because I didn't know what the mansion, you know, everybody's heard the rumors. Oh, there's going to be orgies. There's grotto. Women are walking around naked. And so I didn't want any part of that. I just wanted to say I've been there. Well, the weekend, I got there on Thursday night. So there's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I stayed in my room. I never came out. On Sunday, I decided, well, I'll wait till everybody goes to sleep, and then I'm going to sneak downstairs. I'm going to, you know, go down and look at everything. I'm going to look at the swimming pool, the grotto, and just see what, you know, what it looks like. I was very curious. So I did that, not realizing that Hef slept in the day and stayed up all night. So I get down to the grotto and I hear my name, Susie, Susie. And then I feel a hand on my shoulder. I said, "Hi, honey, why don't you sit down for a minute?" So I sit down and Hef said, "You know, I hear that you're afraid, and you don't need to be afraid. Anything and everything you want here, you can have. You do not need to be afraid. If there's anything you want to try, you just tell me and I'll make sure that you're safe. And, you know, tomorrow's a big day for you. And I'm just so happy to have you as part of the family." And so I'm thinking, this is the first time anybody's ever been so into me and so sweet to me and offering me, you know, safety and to be part of a family. I mean, to be part of the family was like, oh my gosh, a family. I've always wanted a family, and they all live here in this beautiful mansion.
That was your vulnerability at that point, wasn't it? You wanted, yeah. You craved a family, you craved safety.
Yeah, yeah. And it was all about family, at least that's what he always said to me. It was all about family at the mansion. And so I just totally dropped my guard. And at that moment, I'm like, I'm finally safe. You know, I would have done anything for this grandfatherly figure, you know, just to have him be proud of me. And the next day was the day I was supposed to go in for my test shots on Sunset Boulevard at the Playboy studio. And I asked specifically that the photographer that I had in Utah be the same photographer that took those pictures. And they agreed, which made me feel very much relieved because I really felt comfortable with this photographer. So little by little, the clothes came off. And by the end of the day, with much wine, I had taken my first nude photos.
How did you deal with that psychologically? What did it, you know, put me in that moment, what that felt like?
So picture yourself, even yourself as a man. Everybody wants to feel beautiful and everyone craves positive attention. I don't think there's anyone in the world that doesn't. I was in a studio with a photographer, a makeup artist, a hairstylist, someone that would cater to every whim I had. In the middle of the shoot, I became hungry and they asked what I want. And I said, well, what can I have? And they said, you can have anything. I mean, that's the first time I've ever heard those words. So I had never even had sushi, but I said, oh, I'd like to try sushi. And it appeared within half an hour, sushi. Oh, well, I'd like to have some champagne. Well, champagne appeared like within 30 seconds. And everyone was, you know, doing my hair, my makeup, telling me how beautiful I was and how beautiful the pictures were. And then I got to look at the pictures and I'd never seen myself look like that. You know, granted, it took thousands of pictures to get the right picture, but I'd never seen myself look so feminine and beautiful. And like, I've never looked like a woman like that. So, you know, it's lighting, it's makeup, it's angles, but they were trying to make me look just gorgeous. And so that's, there's something in you that loves that everybody's trying to make you look good, and it's all about you, and it can be intoxicating. And that day I definitely became intoxicated with the attention.
Did seeing that layout, did that affect the way you saw yourself?
No, really it didn't. I had seen the pictures so many times. And really I was trying to get to the end of it. There was a means to the end, and the means to the end was to gain respect, attention, and money. And I had been pushed down, beat up, used for so many years that I wanted to be somebody. And I knew I'd never, ever be anything in the eyes of my family. They would never, ever respect me as a human being, and especially not as a woman. But other people were starting to want my autograph and getting attention from really important people that never gave me the time of day before, just because they wanted to hear the stories I'm telling you. Everybody seemed all of a sudden, back then Playboy was a very big deal. And I was one of a few that got to be a centerfold. So everybody wanted to be around me, and my confidence level went up, you know, in years to come. That would definitely change, because now nobody ever talks about that part of my life anymore, because I've kept my promise to God that I would save kids if he let me live through my childhood. So now, you know, I've been on Oprah, I've been on Good Morning America, I've been on Fox, CNN, just about, you name it, I've been on there, because of what I do in the world and the promise that I kept. People don't really ask me much about the Playboy thing anymore, because now I thought that being a playmate was a really big deal, but now I'm older and I'm taking care of 8,000 people a month, mostly children. And that's pretty epic. And those stories really overshadow taking my clothes off for a season.
Absolutely. I think people need to understand what you've been through in order to really appreciate what you're doing now, the great things you're doing with your life.
Yeah.
You lived that Playboy lifestyle at the mansion for about a year, right? What was the mansion like?
Well, it was fabulous for a time. I felt so spoiled. I had everything at my fingertips. I never paid a bill. I had gotten an apartment, but I just never really went there. I enjoyed being with the girls. We traveled so much that it was easier for me to just stay at the mansion and go to the airport from the mansion and then come back and go home to the mansion where I wasn't alone. And had, when you travel with the same girls all the time, it's such a bonding experience. And we traveled all over the world, and I had never been anywhere. So that was an experience I can't say that I could ever replace. However, about a year later, I had just a complete and total disaster again. I was staying in a bedroom that was about, maybe 50 feet from Hefner's bedroom. And I was in my room with one of my girlfriends, also a playmate. And we were talking about Playmate of the Year. And I was like, I'm going to have to go home to Utah if I don't get it, because if this isn't going to be my career, then I need to get back to my real job, because I got to have an income. Everyone else had a family to go home to, but I did not. So she pressured me, you need to go talk to Hef about it. I'm like, no, it's too late. She said, Susie, he just got up. You should go talk to Hef. Go talk to him. She was playing with my hair and doing my makeup. And she goes, you look so pretty. Go talk to him and ask him about Playboy, Playmate of the Year. And that was $100,000. And to me, that would have meant I could get my brother into an apartment with me, and I could take care of him and not travel quite as much and maybe get him back into school. So it was a real important thing that I try very hard to be the best spokesman for Playboy, to not get so into the cocaine and alcohol, which was extremely prevalent there. So I really was on my best behavior, and I was a really incredible spokesman for Playboy. I spoke at a Super Bowl in front of 40,000 people and did a phenomenal job for a teenager, and many, 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 many other events and television shows. So I thought that I had a good chance. So I went down the hall and I knocked on the door, and Hef opened the door and said, Susie, come in. I'm so happy to see you. And I said, oh, listen, I am so sorry to bother you this late. I just wanted to talk to you about a few things. I've been extremely anxious and a bit nervous about my future, and I need to just have a talk with you about that, if it's okay. He said, you just look so stressed. I said, I am. He said, oh, well, take one of these. And he popped one in his mouth, and I popped what he gave me in my mouth, I'm thinking, oh, well, if he's taking it, it's probably okay. I'm thinking it's either a Tylenol or maybe a Xanax or something like that. I'd never heard of Quaaludes in my life, but that turned out to be what I took. I don't remember if I ever started the conversation with him about Playmate of the Year. I remember starting to feel sleepy and silly and thought I should go back to my room and apologizing. And then don't remember anything. I don't know how many hours went by. When I woke up, it was starting to get light. And he was on top of me. I don't know how many times he had been on top of me through that night. So I woke up with this elderly man that I thought was like a really good grandfather figure, someone who would take care of me and keep me safe, raping me. And he was finishing when I woke up, and I started to try to push him off of me. I was completely shocked at where I was and why I didn't have my pants on. My pajama bottoms were off, and it made him mad. I could see that he was mad, and I'd never seen him mad before. And when he got off of me, I just kept trying to find my pajama bottoms. I just needed to get those and get out of there. And then he said to me, "You need to get out of here. Shannon's going to be here any minute." That was his girlfriend. And I'm like, I have to find my panties. I have to find my pajamas. And I found my pajamas. I never found my underwear. I found out later that he kept all of our underwear when he did that. So I had to shoot. I had to do a photo shoot that day. I believe it was for, I can't remember, a poster or a calendar, but I went back to my room and I laid in my bed and just cried and cried and thought, what has happened? What has happened? This is going to ruin everything.
So did you put that painful memory, did you put it in a box and lock it away?
Yes, I had to. I had to. I had to do it. I had no other option. I needed my paycheck. I knew from other girls that your paycheck could be withheld, and I still had not been paid the full amount for my centerfold. And I had rent to pay in LA, which was very expensive. And I decided I was never going to live at the mansion again. So my apartment became really important to me. And I had by then quit my job in Utah. And I had promised my little brother that he was going to get to come live with me, a place where he could be safe. So I thought, well, I've been through it once. I can get through it again. But you don't get through it. You just don't. It takes therapy. And for anybody out there who's listening, don't think that, you know, your friends, or even if you have a good family, they cannot be your source of therapy. They're not equipped. You have to talk to someone who's trained how to talk to you. It's not possible to get through it by yourself. You'll get disorders, you'll get night terrors, you'll turn to drugs, alcohol, anything to keep it suppressed. But it never stays suppressed. You have to work through it.
When you finally left the Playboy experience, did you feel like you were escaping something?
Yes. Yes. I felt like someday I was going to tell. And I did. I started telling my story, because almost every interview that I would do, the introduction to that interview would be Susie Scott, Miss May, 1983, still working for Playboy. And at some point I thought, you know what, I need to tell what the Playboy experience was. The good and the bad. And I'm not saying that it wasn't a fantasy for a good year. It was, but it turned into a nightmare. And just recently on the A&E network, there was a docuseries where not only myself, but several other women who I had no idea had the exact same experiences of being raped and drugged by Heath. So it gave me the opportunity to talk to them, which was so healing. I now talk to these girls almost every day on text or what's up. And it just validates my soul to know that it really did happen the way I remember it, because you kind of want to believe, no, it didn't happen. It just didn't, that couldn't have happened. It couldn't have happened. And then listening to them tell their stories of the exact same method of drugging and waking up without your clothes on. I tell you, it's otherworldly to think that that kind of evil could happen in the eyes of the world, and people know about it. People knew about it. The day after it happened to me, people knew about it, and they brushed it under the rug. And now I've written a book, and I've told the entire story, my story of what happened in the book. And it's coming out, and Hefner's legacy will never, ever, ever be the same.
Some years later, after one bad marriage, right, you met a guy named Joe.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you meet?
He was my divorce attorney.
That's convenient.
Yes, I married very young, a man that I met in LA. I had no idea that he had several different identities and had been married to yet another Playboy playmate who died under very mysterious circumstances. And he was finally imprisoned. The FBI caught him while I was married to him. And that was here in Aspen. We lived here in Aspen. He had five different passports, five different lives. And I was 21 at the time. And everything, all of our assets, or what I thought were our assets, were really not our assets. So I was homeless for about 2 weeks here in Aspen. And a friend of mine was kind enough to let me stay in the barn. And I walked up and down the streets of the West End in Aspen, knocking on doors saying, you know, I can cook, I can clean, I can, you know, do anything that you need me to do for you. Just all I need is room and board. That's it. Food and a place to sleep.
Thanks to Lane McGivney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life, and audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You too can become an American Achiever.